Welcome to Polycast, a civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Mian Team.
Mad Jin.
With guest co-host
Grimvec.
I've not been paying any attention to anything except for that part, because I thought that was amusing.
I'm just going to truncate that. Magic has not been paying attention to anything.
Exactly.
Episode 247. I'm Grimvec, a perfectly nice guy. And we have Dan Q.
I'm a panelist. I oversaw the placement of my co-panelists. I set the topics, edit the recording, and publish it on the show. But I can say without bias, this is going to be a great episode.
Makalua.
Dan makes me get up early on Saturday mornings to do this.
Medjin.
I'm already awake, but still, I only just show up.
And the Mian Team.
As you all know, I am also a perfectly nice guy.
Hint, the nice guys like nukes.
Isn't it?
It's an important part of diplomacy.
It is the extension of diplomacy.
Exactly.
We bring you love.
We would never use them unless we have to.
Yes, warm nuclear hugs for the rest of your life.
Exactly. It's a lifelong gift.
Warm nuclear hugs and diplomacy, or failing at diplomacy. That might be a segue into our first topic.
Lack of diplomacy.
Yes, lack of diplomacy. On the last episode of this show, we reported on the early December announcement of an almost two-month delay for North American and Europeans looking to get their hands on Civilization Revolution 2 Plus, a Civ title for the handheld PlayStation Vita. This announcement came the day before the expected worldwide availability, but it did launch in Asia unscheduled. Criticism was levied on both this region delay and the timing of the announcement, but it was more about the timing of the announcement rather than the content that got most of the criticism. The revised release date for North America and Europe was then January 26th. So now we're recording the day after, so on January 22nd, the announcement came that, oh, the North American and European release has been delayed again with the vague, quote-unquote, later this year. If we're going to be conservative about that, then I guess perhaps maybe the second half of 2016, but when I hear later this year, I think more of the last quarter of this year, but they've definitely given themselves some wiggle room. Along with the sentence, quote, "The team is hard at work making sure the title lives up to fans' expectations, and we appreciate your continued patience as we take the time needed to prepare the title for global release in 2016, as published on the official Civilization Facebook page."
Except for all you people in Asia who've had a crappy version of the game for at least a month. Everything in that announcement's just like a good joke. We're gonna do a global release, but we want to clean up the code first. But what about those people in Asia?
Does anyone here even own a Vita?
No.
I don't know. Is this a way to try to get people in Asia to play Civilization Online because Civilization Revolution 2 Plus is just annoying them so much because of the issues that it must have?
Yeah, and at least this time, they did give, what, 6 days head start before the release?
Three.
Okay, well, they're getting better.
It's better. Yeah.
But now they must have learned, don't put a date down.
That is progress.
Progress. Don't tell anybody anything.
5% score to a 6% score is progress, so...
Yeah.
But as has been pointed out in the Facebook comments, Jacob Morgan, wait, what? Didn't it already get an English release in Asia? I'm okay with waiting for the Western release, but I'm surprised by the delay. To which Jason Puglisiani said, yeah, I have the Asian one, and it's fully finished and in English. I didn't even have to select the language. So it's not that you are completely without options, which also is another head-scratcher as well, as if we didn't have enough already.
That makes no sense, because I was going to ask if localization was holding them up, but apparently not. So why can't they make copies for the U.S.?
Maybe it's a legal problem somewhere.
Nah, it would make a lot less sense. They would have resolved their legal issues before setting a date for release.
Yeah, probably.
Is 2K just concerned that no one's going to be talking about Civilization Revolution 2 Plus after it's released, so therefore they have these delays so we keep talking about it?
Yeah. That's it.
No! Sneaky marketing strategy.
It's just going to be like Duke Nukem Forever. It'll be great.
And then it'll come out and everybody will be like, seriously, what the hell?
Yeah.
That's the route they've started going, so, you know.
At least Duke Nukem Forever was forever not until it was, full stop, as opposed to this hybrid approach. I liked Stefan Gunner's response. Can you at least tell us why you delayed the game? It's been out in Eastern regions for months now. You are trolling your fans. Quite honestly, I think we've moved beyond trolling.
They have fans.
Seriously, at this point, most people that really, really wanted it could have had it imported from Asia.
And some have.
That's right. So I can just see it now. It's finally released in North America and Europe, and anyone who is interested in getting it already has it. And then the sales are really bad in that region.
And then everybody else gave up and wandered away.
And then when you have Civilization Revolution 2 Plus Platinum Edition, it only gets released in Asia because there was no interest for it in North America or Europe.
Yep.
Air quotes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. The path is laid out before us.
Totally.
Apparently, we forgot to go over everything that Mega Bear Strand has done, so we have a few more civs to go over. In this case, Rome.
Last July, we talked about Mega Bear Strand revisiting the Ottomans, which was, quote, about the legacy civilizations that has not had explicit changes but may have had their strategies significantly altered by the two expansions and other updates. Mega Bear Strand has published three articles since then about this, but seeing as how there was a lot of news about a certain other Civ title about that time last year, it kind of got pushed until now, but still completely relevant, I assure you. And again, I'm not biased.
Totally.
Well, his short notes published the thread originally. He did say he had originally planned his strategy around the assumption that the glory of Rome ability was going to buff internal production trade routes, but actually it's the other thing. This is the thing where if you build something in the capital, it's a discount when you build it elsewhere. So he's got some strategy here for planning that out, or at least trying to remember to build those things in your capital first before you try to build them in other cities, because I forget that all the time with Rome. I know that it can. And also, using the road-building capabilities of legions. Now, that one's fun.
Yeah, see, I think more about that when I think of Rome than the glory of Rome or even the ballista. It's the legion, the ability to construct roads with legions, but then also the combat strength.
I'm just going to throw in a Dan's all wrong comment there, because I think he is. Glory of Rome, if you set up your strategy properly, you just rush by all buildings in Rome, and that is a very nice cost reduction everywhere else, which means how much you spend in one place has a lot more impact across your empire, depending on how big you make it, of course. The bigger, the better.
Yeah,
it would be a lot stronger without the tall versus wide stuff going on.
Yeah, yeah. If there was no silly go to four cities and stop crap, then
really good.
Yes, Glory of Rome just gets better the more and more and more you add.
Again, when I think of Rome, I think more of what the legions can do as opposed to what Glory of Rome can do.
I just remember the most common issue. If you are Rome, you will not have iron anywhere near you. Scruff.
Yeah.
So legions
pretty much
questionable.
At least you can build ballistas.
Yes.
Exactly.
Legions don't shoot either. That is a problem.
Yeah, ranged units are always better.
But if you adequately use your ballistas and take over enemy territory that has iron, then you can get said legions that you may have otherwise been deprived of.
Yeah, and then you can build roads. Perfect.
Yay.
Hey, or you could
armored workers, dude.
Or you could have just built a worker and had the
Well, no, you're
away.
Using that for military purposes by repeatedly getting the AI to capture it and then killing the unit that captured it and taking it back.
Is that true?
And then you can have your workers constructing improvements other than roads, and you could have your legions doing that. The strong legions that can actually fight can be doing that, and then if you have some damaged legions, you can move them to the back, and they can start completing the road between your existing network and then whatever new cities you're able to capture.
Yeah, but if they're building roads, they're not fortified, and they can't act as meat shield as well.
Yep.
Yeah, which is pretty much why you would have a melee unit that's not mounted in the first place.
That's why you have your at full strength or near full strength legions providing that support for your ballistas and have the weaker ones in the back completing the roads.
I mean, it's not the worst unit in the game for unique, but it's not like amazing at all.
I acknowledge it very much dependent on how much iron you have.
It's good for dropping a bunch of roads down so your ballistas can actually move around because they're slow and annoying. So yeah, if you've got a bunch of heavy land, like hills and trees and stuff, you can get your legions in there to quick filled roads, then your ballistas can use those and get the height bonuses for range without having to also take along a bunch of workers. So there's that nice bit. And they're stronger, just in general. And then there's something about building forts, but who does that?
Who builds forts?
Yeah.
It is nice to have an excuse to build siege earlier, just because normally crossbows just trounce it for so long.
And if you get yourself your legion, seeing as how they do not become obsolete with steel, they become obsolete with gunpowder, then you can go through the path of, hey, let's get the legion, let's get those nice upgrades that carry over on promotion, and then they can become super awesome long swords. And then if you're constructing units otherwise for whatever reason, you wouldn't build a quote-unquote vanilla long swords until if and when you're at a point that you can no longer construct legions because you're at gunpowder, although in which case at that point you're probably thinking about switching away from long swords anyway.
Mm-hmm. Legion don't have nice upgrades. Unless you've promoted them by fighting.
Yeah, no, the build road thing doesn't stick around, so.
Yes, I'm talking about the promotions that you would get through combat. Yes, not the ability to continue to construct roads.
But I think that's a big part of a good unique unit, though, is that you can build it, and then it has the unique promotion that you could just upgrade into other stuff and have it for pretty much the rest of the game till you lose the unit.
And then that's also the question of how unique is that then really, though, if that carries over on upgrade. And I know we've talked about this before, like those upgrades that are specific to the unit that you can't get otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, those are better mathematically than, or even objectively, than something that gets something while it's that unit and only while it's that unit.
But then there's also the question of being able to utilize that particular unit when it is strong in that point of the game, and that's relative to your progression through the technology tree, your opponent's progression through the technology tree, whether you're playing against AI and or humans.
Yeah. No, Legions, if you have iron, like if you have got a 6-stack of iron right next to your capital, Legions, awesome. Go rush iron working and like smash crap, because you can run through somebody else's pile of composite bow spam. But the ballista itself is not really that good.
I enjoyed them more before we had the introduction of composite bowmen.
It does get less one-shotted by cities than catapults.
Yeah, I mean, ballistas are 2 up on their range strength from catapults, but that's about it. Like, that 2 points, yes, because you have that extra 200% bonus, so it's a multiple, so it actually really cranks it up versus the other ones if you're attacking a city, but,
True enough.
So if you're finding yourself fighting against Rome, to a point that's been brought up several times, without early access to iron, Rome is not nearly as much of a military threat. Yes, well, that Rome isn't a particularly difficult civilization to defeat in open conflict, as long as you don't get caught up in the conflict with them at their peak of their unique units' window of effectiveness, which I think we can supplant Rome as the name of civilization for any other civilization you want, Civilization 5, and have that sentence in there, and that would be factual.
Yep. Don't attack them while they're strong.
Rome can be a little bit more challenging to beat economically. Their production bonuses means that they should have, I enjoy that qualifier, should have multiple highly productive cities earlier than many other civilizations can achieve, as well as very well improved terrain. So that also gets back to, especially through Brave New World, these things called internal trade routes. Either it's for food and or production, so food so you can work more production tiles, or if you know, oh, this is going to be a really heavy food city, but there isn't a lot of production here, then sending production to those cities, especially the capital, to tie back to the glory of Rome, so that the capital constructs it faster, and then in turn your other cities can construct it faster. But also, with the economic point, buying things in cities, if you get that and you can have decent trade routes that are going to be getting you gold and you can protect them, whether they're along the road or across open water or a combination of the two, then you can buy those buildings in Rome, save your production for something else, and then also now get the glory of Rome production benefit for all of your other cities.
Mm-hmm.
Sure. Augustus's AI is one of the least trustworthy in the game. Avoid trading with him if you can. This will have the added benefit of limiting his economic growth, which can make it difficult for him to pay the upkeep for a large army and extensive infrastructure. It can be difficult to build any kind of meaningful relationship with Augustus, and even if you do, he will attack you if he feels he has a stronger military. His military might is generally hit or miss. And of course, this kind of goes a little bit out the window if you random personalities. He's also fairly tolerant of warmongers, so if you're not being aggressive towards him, you know, as soon as you declare war on him, oh, he's very tolerant of warmongers, even though I declared war on him. That's probably at that point he's not going to be really liking you very much, if you know at all. But in that sense, if it's kind of like, okay, I'll get to Rome eventually, but there's especially when it's this window where he's using his legions and his ballistas, so you can go and conquer those civs over there. I'll go conquer those civs over here. We'll be happier, maybe not happy, happier with each other as a relative term because we're both warmongers, and then we can wipe each other out for ultimate domination of the map or region of the map.
Mm-hmm.
If we're trying to abstract to, are they an upper tier civ? Are they a middle tier civ? Are they a lower tier civ? To me, they're kind of like middle of the middle because you can take advantage, but if things also don't line up, then you are at a disadvantage.
Yeah, well, they're definitely a map-based issue, civ.
One comment that came up in the civ community in response, John C. Nunn says, you are probably playing on too low a difficulty level if you're seeking domination victory and have so much time to spare that you can build the Statue of Zeus. It's less about the part about if you're seeking domination victory and Statue of Zeus, then you're probably playing on too low difficulty level. To which Mega Bears fan responds, these strategies aren't intended only for high difficulty levels. They're intended for all players at all skill levels and game speeds. So I guess the target audience for these posts is more those intermediate players, but I certainly hope that they contain useful information and tips for high-level players as well. And I try to point out places where changes in strategy might be necessary for high-level and multiplayer play.
You see, I'm not sure I like the philosophy of strategies just for middle difficulties. If it's one of those things where it becomes optimal, if you're playing on, say, Prince or King or whatever, and it's not viable on DD, that's different. Because then you have a strategy specific to the difficulty level that's reasonable to pursue if you're on that difficulty for optimization purposes. Okay, fine. But for the most part, the reason you don't do something on DD would not change the reason that you would not do it on Prince. It's just a matter of you can get away with mistakes on Prince. But I would not advocate something that would typically be a mistake on DD that is still technically a mistake on Prince, but you can get away with it as a strategy in a write-up about a civ.
Well, no, see, going after, say, the Great Library.
Well, okay.
On DD, that would be a mistake unless you luck into a bunch of civs who don't want it, or if you don't have the forest to chop completely. So going after it, maybe 3, 4, 10% best case scenario that you might get it on DD, but at Emperor, it's 100% of the time you should get it. Because
fair
it's
enough.
That powerful.
But that's an example of the first thing I mentioned.
Yeah.
That's not everything. There's a lot of things that are not optimal on DD, and they're still not optimal on Prince. They're just not good to do.
Yeah.
I think there should be a distinction drawn between those two things, because your Great Library example is an excellent counterexample.
Shred Roots on DD. You want those faster because you get tons of science from the AIs who have more tech than you, because it's DD.
And they're dirt bonuses.
Yeah, and they are less vulnerable, lesser difficulties.
Mm-hmm. And on lower difficulties, yeah, they don't start with 4 extra techs. So it becomes less optimal to rush trade routes to them because you're not going to get a lot.
Given that Mega Bears fan has acknowledged that he is an intermediate level player, he talks about not playing on Immortal Deity, so I expect he's playing on Emperor, which is what I do. I'm glad that he is talking about from his experience. He's not trying to talk about Immortal or Deity strategies when he himself does not play it, but that he is upfront about what it is for and that he's willing to acknowledge that he will make revisions. I would just like to see in his article, regardless of the nature of the revision, if you change something that's content related, I mean, if you fix a comma or a period or capitalization, fine. But if you make a change, then include a little change log somewhere so that if someone looked at it yesterday and then they decide to go back to that strategy tomorrow and you've made a change, it jumps out at you, oh, I should be paying attention to this because that has been changed.
No. Dan just wants his own personal notation device. And he wants other people to do it for him.
No, that's called being accountable in your publishing.
Speaking of nations that are map dependent, holy cow. Yeah. Next up, we have Mega Bear Fan article on the Iroquois. And yeah, these guys, and he points it out as well, you live or die by your forest tiles to some degree when it comes to actually utilizing your uniques in a meaningful capacity anyway. And if you're not, then you basically get a resourceless swordsman and nothing else if you have no forest. Oh, and a downgraded thing with a longhouse. You get a weaker workshop, yeah.
Mm.
Okay, if you have jungle, then yeah, that workshop is not going to be able to help you, although units could still move more quickly in friendly territory, just like they were forests.
Yeah, okay, true. Jungle can be okay as well, I guess.
Yay.
I mean, there's some niceness there. Like, if you're not paying for roads, that's helpful. You don't have to take the worker turns to build them. That's a pretty significant early game benefit, and if you're actually fighting enemies in the forest and jungle, then I guess it's still a swordsman unit, which isn't great, but at least you're not dependent on iron.
And you don't have to worry about the maintenance costs for the roads as well.
Also, yeah. Because if you fight in your territory, all those forests and jungle count as roads, which means you can move around way faster than anybody who's fighting in your territory.
And that includes across a river.
And that includes mounted units.
Free bridge.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like with Hiawatha, you want crap ton of forests and jungle, whatever, and then mass bomb your culture. And then if anybody attacks you, you can run around them in circles and smash up all their stuff. It means flanking bonuses are much easier to get.
Oh, stacking flanking bonuses at the forest combat. Yeah, I mean, if you're getting all that going, then it's pretty sound. But man, you better have all that. You better have the forest in the first place.
Oh, yeah. Whoever you declare on, or whoever declares on you to come at you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of his write-up then goes on to talk about how you're working in the forest if you do get it. Like, you're going to prioritize food because there's not a lot of food naturally if you're working forest tiles and trying
or
to set
jungle.
Up. Yeah, or jungle. Jungle's kind of rough early on.
Jungle's really rough early on.
Like, I don't care if you're Iroquois. That's going to hurt. You can move around a little better and fight a little better, but that's not going to be great.
Yeah, well, thank goodness for the Brave New World internal trade routes that can potentially get you production.
Yeah, but everybody gets access to those. Like, you'll still be relatively behind on a jungle start compared to just about anything else. Now, granted, that does, on a percentage basis, help you out. So you're not as completely and utterly hosed if you're using internal trade routes as you would be if they did not exist. However, you are still at a pretty big disadvantage if you start in the middle of a friggin' jungle without any, like, decent resources or city sites to bail you out on that.
Yeah, but the moment you hit universities...
Yeah, I mean, assuming you can get to them and nothing awful happens to you before you get there, then yeah, you get a big science boost, finally.
And then trade post spam.
Yeah.
And even before that, if you are the Iroquois, I would rather be the Iroquois and be like, oh crap, look at all this jungle, as opposed to being, say, Rome. Oh, crap. Look at all this jungle.
Fair enough. I don't agree with the opening piety for them, though. To get the pantheons that you would want for food or whatnot, I don't think that's worth what you're giving up to take piety in the first place.
Nah, especially because if you're not really shoving towards it.
I mean, if you're cherry tapping and you just want to take piety, then nah, fine. But I don't think that would help.
I'd say liberty is better.
Yeah.
You want to make use of forests and or jungle, preferably forests. But food is also an issue. It's like, am I going to be able to work these particular tiles? Am I going to be able to grow? So if you're able to, with your pantheon, to get the +1 food from camps, it's kind of like, hey, I can work that. Oh, but that's going to require me chopping down the forest in order to get that food. I'm trying to minimize that as much as possible. So really, your best cities are going to be for the Iroquois is you're going to have a combination of, I'm just going to set jungle aside, you're going to have forest and non-forest, and the forest being as much of a continuation as possible. So you can connect your cities together, but still have enough non-forest tiles for food and or be able to get those camps. But seeing as how you're probably, on most maps, going to want tiles that can actually get you farms, because they're not going to be as situational. It's going to be a more frequent opportunity to have that as opposed to camps in the first place. Then you're going to want a combination of that kind of terrain. It's not a one step forward, two step back sort of thing. Because I think with the Iroquois, you can become really obsessed with, okay, this is a limited ability. It's very map dependent, but I'm just going to go gung-ho about it and not think about the bigger picture. Because unless you're able to take out opponents very quickly, because it's a really small map or you're just steamrolling, you got to be thinking about the longer term game when other people come knocking at your door.
Now, if you're talking about the bigger picture, however, how is the food from getting access to these boosted camps comparing to just opening and filling out tradition and running internal trade routes? You get those aqueducts up so much faster. That's a lot of food. You get the bonuses in the capital and the bonuses to growth in general. I'm not buying that the chance of missing the camp bonus from that is anywhere near comparable if you're just caring about food and a food poor start to just opening tradition.
Yeah, I'm not saying this is an isolation or instead of opening tradition. I'm just saying it kind of goes along with it. And also when we're talking about concerns about the map, where do I settle?
It has to be instead of, or else you're not taking piety in order to secure the early stuff for your Pantheon. Like,
I don't think that the Pantheon that you want is as likely to be taken, first off, by another AI than you. But even if it does, if you then open tradition, because even then if you lose out on that Pantheon, then like you're saying, then you're not going to have to worry about that. And maybe you could grab just like a generic growth thing to combine on top of the tradition, like fertility rights, for example, for plus 10% growth.
Or keep that civ alive long enough to get their religion. And then you get it eventually anyways.
Yeah, if they're in the immediate vicinity, yeah.
And then wipe them out so that they don't get the defender bonus.
I also don't think it's worth gunning a religion like that to the point of taking piety just for that.
See, I'm not advocating going to open piety. I'm just saying if you're going to go for religion...
Oh yeah, absolutely then.
Or at least go for a pantheon. I can see how you thought that, given that you pointed out the part about him saying to open piety. I agree that that's not worth it.
Okay, all right.
But at the same time, it's also, don't think about, oh, I'm not going to open piety, so then I should just ignore religion potential. Well, you definitely don't want to ignore pantheon potential. Because even if you get overrun by another religion, oh, I don't actually get to found a religion, or all the kind of good stuff is taken. Well, then by that point, by the time it comes around to you, then perhaps you're not so worried about that initial boost that you were getting from the plus one food from camps, given the combination of number of camps that you do have combined with other food sources, i.e. tradition opening.
You can often still get a religion, especially if you're not on one of the highest levels. It's really easy to pick up a religion.
You can finish Liberty.
Yeah, I mean, even if you go Tradition, though, it's below Immortal, and you just build like a shrine kind of sort of early, you stand a pretty good chance of getting a Pantheon and then eventually a religion.
Yeah, it just depends on who else is in the game. Obviously, certain civs will beeline it, and others won't.
Yeah, but I'm saying, like, most of the time you'll get one. Most of the time, an Emperor below.
Yeah, as for opening Tradition, even if you're going to go Liberty... With the Iroquois, I'd almost say open tradition anyways as the first move, because if you're in a bunch of forests, you're not really going to have a lot of gold right away, even jungle. So you might want the tradition opener to help with getting more forests in your territory and basically expanding your borders out as much as possible, even if you go Liberty, because it will reduce it. And then, you know, the more space you have, the more you can run around. Anyways, longhouses... They're useful in respect of they'll give you more production on the map, but they lack the 10%. So do they still have the engineer?
Yes, they do.
Yep.
Okay. If you have a high pop city with a lot of forests, you get a lot of base production, but you don't have the 10% production bonus. Now, granted, that 10% production bonus could actually be less than the flat production in the early to mid game, because you might not have a lot in the first place.
Yes, which goes to Mega Bear's fan points that the longhouse can be considered inferior to the building that it replaces, but as we're getting at, not necessarily, and at the time of the game that you're talking about.
I think if we're talking about working a forest city, the longhouse is definitely better. But the problem is that you might not have that.
Yeah.
Because if you're talking about a 10% bonus with a workshop, the longhouse only needs to work one hex to overcome 10% production otherwise.
Yeah.
That's not too difficult. And if you're emphasizing forest anyway, because you're the Iroquois, you're probably going to be working a lot of forest, at which point you're getting 5-6 bonus hammers from working forest tiles in the longhouse, and you would need massive, massive base production to have that 10% get anywhere near.
Mm-hmm.
And a longhouse is also cheaper than a workshop, so you can get it up more quickly.
Yeah, so you start with a hammer advantage as well. Yeah. I don't think it's that bad a building. I don't like that it's as situational as it is, but it doesn't bother me as a building's design. It has an up and a down to it, but its advantage can be pretty significant.
Mm-hmm. And you can always continue to improve it. So you can improve the forest. You don't have to leave it empty.
Yeah.
Which means that you can throw on lumber mills, make them even more productive, yada, yada, yada.
And like Civ 4, you can actually get lumber mills reasonably early in 5.
Yeah.
That too. I mean, it also goes all back to being map dependent. I mean, if you do not have forest or even jungle around, then for the most part, Iroquois, pretty milk toast.
Yeah, they don't need iron. that's their benefit at that point.
And if you're going against the Iroquois, quoting Mega Bears fan, I have found the Hiawatha AI to be one of the most dangerous and competitive AIs in the game, and I'm certainly not alone in that assessment. He seems to have the perfect combination of expansiveness, aggressiveness, and diplo balance, and he's always a threat in my games. He builds new cities rapidly and almost always has a strong defensive army, possibly due to not needing iron. Despite being so strong, Hiawatha is rarely openly hostile. His aggression and deception balance is one of the lowest in the game, and his loyalty score is one of the highest. Hiawatha's more or longer dislike is also on the higher end, so he can turn on you rather suddenly if you start capturing capitals or city-states. Well, that's just being aware of who else is on the map and where they are.
Oh, and of course, the ultimate counter to the Iroquois.
Get down Hayes Forest.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Burn it all.
Your car go, don't worry, I will just replant the fort. Oh, wait, no, this isn't Sinfort.
Oh, right. No. Can't do it.
It was an interesting comment by Mega Bears fan. I kind of went pause on it after I read it, which was, quote, a player-controlled Iroquois is less likely to be as dangerous as the AI one, since the player lacks the handicaps at the higher difficulties that really help push Hiawatha over the edge. Whether playing against a human or AI-controlled Iroquois, they can still be a good ally or trade partner. This part about being less likely to be as dangerous as the AI, I think about that less about the AI, but more about the player controlling the Iroquois and recognizing the strengths and weaknesses of playing as them. I don't think that a player-controlled Iroquois is less likely to be as dangerous as the AI, because we as humans have a better ability to think and adapt to an individual circumstance. No, I mean, I think it's possible.
Specifically mentioning handicaps, which means that he's specifically mentioning, say, growth bonuses, as in, I need less food to get another population point. An AI than the human does. And, well, yeah, and the happiness bonus. So basically, they grow faster and they will be stronger just because of the handicap than a human player can possibly do. Yeah, a human player will go and mass compo, rush, blah, 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 blah. But just as a, can they build it bigger and stronger as an empire? No. Clearly, if you leave an AI alone, the handicaps will outrun you.
If you're looking within the scope of what the Iroquois can do specifically as compared to the other civilizations, okay. But like you were saying, it's like, I don't know, a player-controlled Iroquois is less likely to be maybe as dangerous as the AI one and then have something in there about the Iroquois' actual ability as opposed to just a civilization outright. Because as you said, a human player may more likely be able to compensate for, oh, the AI is stronger than I am, so I guess I should be having, say, more siege weapons or ranged weapons in order to combat what the AI is going to be able to do as an Iroquois player, being Iroquois specifically.
He was talking about the bonuses. He even said it, the handicap.
I know he did, but to me it's too broad about being less likely to be a dangerous one. Okay, yes, he's talking about the handicaps, but tie it more specifically to the fact about what the Iroquois can do as a player-controlled Iroquois. It just seems like we're just talking full stop, regardless of what else you can do in the game. I don't think that's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay. One thing in here I have to take issue with, because this is just obviously bad advice. When he's talking about the longhouses, you know, whether it's good or bad, otherwise it's really only useful as a prereq for the ironworks and factories, true, if you have no forests or very little, and you might want to delete the worthless longhouse after building a factory in that city. Because it still has two base production, it's not worthless. And it still has the engineering slot, so if you just want engineers, it's not worthless. And even if it is crappy yield, which you can say at that point, it is really low yield, why would you go around deleting buildings?
Yeah, it's a combination of the great engineer slot plus why are you spending time doing that where you may be ahead. Yay, I saved the maintenance, as opposed to spending your time and attention on something else, which is going to give you bigger bang for your buck, so to speak.
It's only 2 gold per turn.
Yeah, it's not like that's hard to get over.
Well, and if that's an issue for you in the later game, that 2 gold per turn, you've got some bigger problems.
Much bigger problems. Dido is apparently Carthage's queen of the coast. Dido exists, Venetian heritage, so all coastal cities get the free harbor. Isn't that sweet? Very, very useful. And of course, you can cross mountains if you don't feel like keeping them. If you play Carthage, love your coastline. Though amusingly, you still need city connections. So even if you get free harbors, you still need the ability to connect those with
the wheel.
Yeah. Though some of the bonuses for harbors are all based on tech. So you still will have to go through the tech to get the other sides of things. Although less awesome now in Brave New World than they were in Gods and Kings, mostly because the production got moved to lighthouses.
Yeah, that's true.
But they expand trade routes in Brave New World.
Yeah, but you can do sea trade routes, or you can have extra production on coastal stuff without having to waste time researching it. I don't know. I think still in the end, Dido's coastal empire is decently productive. You still want to obviously go get lighthouses anyways if you're on the coast.
Yeah, you might want access to at least some naval units anyway, so there you go.
Because she's also coastal, she gets the Quinquereme, which is just a really buffed up trireme, though not really that useful. Obviously, Byzantine got the better choice here. But since they're up plus 3 from in the combat strength. That puts about 30% boost over top of triremes can be useful, and is extremely useful against coastal cities that don't have walls, because the average combat strength for a city that does not have walls on the coast and not on a hill is less than that, which means that you can crush it.
One extra boosted trireme and take the city from them.
And also good for protecting your coastal trade routes.
Yeah.
If you have any.
Sure.
You should be able to make some at least internal trade routes you continue to settle along the water.
Yeah, yeah, if you're trying to milk the harbors, you might as well, and the yields are better.
Yep. Mountains are your friend, as in putting a wall of mountains between you and the enemy is awesome, especially when you promptly send elephants across it. Do you also have the African forest elephant, which, if you're playing Gedo properly, you probably will never use these things. Unless you get stuck on a map that actually requires you to be on land, which is always bad for Dito, Dido, whatever. They are slower, which does make the mountain crossing a little more dangerous. And they cost more by 25 hammers, which kind of sucks. But they are at least up at 14 combat strength, so they don't necessarily get completely wrecked by iron-based units. Mostly get wrecked by spears still, mostly. But more importantly, they actually have 2 bonuses. So the Great General 2, basically you can generate more Great Generals faster. And Feared Elephant, minus 10% combat penalty for adjacent enemy units. That's actually useful because it effectively negates the flanking bonuses.
The Feared Elephant's promotion does not carry over.
Well, you stop being an elephant, so...
Yep.
Yeah.
But the Great General promotion does.
Yes, yeah. It does.
To me, the African Forest Elephant big draw is, oh, help me get towards that first Great General. So they're definitely not going to be any kind of substantive fighting force, but I like them in there early on, even if it's just going squish on barbs. Similar as well to the, the Quinn, I'm not going to try to pronounce the full name of the other unique unit.
Quinn Cream?
How they're protecting your trade routes there. Use the African Forest Elephant offensively against barbs to help get yourself that Great General for combat against AIs proper.
Also, no horses.
Your workers will even be able to build road on mountain tiles, which is...
I've never tried that.
Well, it only costs 1 movement to go onto the mountain, which to me is amusing. But I don't think I've actually tried building roads on mountains. But I assume that the moment that you can build a road somewhere, that it will still obviously give you the speed bonus, which means that you can jump from one side of the mountain to the other with roads.
It helps with that sneak attack on an enemy flank. Mega Bears fan writes, by the time Carthage reaches the Renaissance, all of your uniques, except the mountain crossing ability, will be rendered moot.
Yeah,
but
you would have built a pretty solid empire on that.
Exactly. You got that forward momentum for you. So you don't want to reach the Renaissance, and then not actually have done those things. Then you should be concerned, and then that was your fault.
Well, you still get the free harbors no matter what.
Yep.
So that's a decent chunk of production per city. And again, the more cities you make, that's more production you saved. And, of course, the more you expand, the more gold from city connections you get right away.
Yep.
You don't have to wait until the harbor's done. So that's an instant income.
Whether it's a natively founded city, conquered puppet, or an annex city, it's free.
Yep.
I think the decision on whether or not to build roads becomes interesting with Carthage if you have mostly or only coastal cities, because they cost money.
Yeah, I think it's also going to depend on, okay, if I'm on the coast and then I'm going to go after another civilization, are they also mostly water-based, or am I going to need some land units? And so you may then decide, oh, I want to be able to move this particular unit more quickly across land in order to get to another city, because they're going to be able to move faster across that road network than they would on water. But at the same time, then that would be something that you would construct perhaps later on in the game for that specific purpose, rather than saying, oh, from the outset, my workers should be concentrating on roads because you're going to have those connections otherwise, and you're on the water otherwise, so you don't need to worry about roads for movement.
Yeah, it's a decent income generator in the early game.
Yeah, and it's non-trivial for your worker turns, too.
Yep.
Turns that you would spend on roads are now turns you're using to building more improvements. So you get by either with fewer workers or just more improvements available sooner.
And the delta on the income is actually decent because harbors themselves actually have a gold cost.
Yes.
You save that much per turn plus the automatic connection.
And then less expense on roads, yeah.
And trade routes.
Yep.
Yep, and in some respects, it is about more income, but it's also about fewer expenses, or at least how long you're going to have certain expenses, i.e. a road network to supplement within your empire.
Well, both of those, but just how fast they come online, though.
Exactly.
All that put together is what makes it pretty solid early on.
So you're still going to need roads.
Maybe not an archipelago, but usually you'd want them.
If you're actually on a fully water map, then you're not going to be able to build roads across some islands anyways. But if you have land and you have, say, going from one side of your continent to the other side, you may want to build a road across the middle anyways, just in case, because you're maybe still have to go around, depending on what's going on.
Yeah, you just keep conquering, and you just don't bother building units on the back lines anymore. Just build them closer to the front.
The world is round. Maybe somebody could figure that out and went the opposite side.
No, you just keep going until you conquer it all. It's like a ball rolling down a hill or something. You just keep going until you hit your own cities again.
No, that's true. You should be able to prove the world is round because then you get a movement bonus. Oh, wait, no, this isn't so
far.
Mega Bears fan notes, I haven't really found Carthage to strongly favor any one victory type over the others, and a Carthage player can lean towards any victory type. Yeah.
Domination.
It's a strength and a weakness, but I think more often than not, that's actually a strength, because if you think you're going one type and then circumstances dictate, uh-oh, maybe not anymore, then you can adapt.
Wrong. Domination.
Wrong. It's a weakness. You don't have an advantage for science victory.
Yeah.
Your advantage for science victory, seeing as how you've got that flavor for mountains, if you actually have mountains and you can settle, then you can have observatories and get even more science.
You always settle next to a mountain when you can, whether you're Carthage or not.
Doesn't matter.
No, but what I'm saying is if you have those mountains, then you're going to be able to construct the observatory, along with the fact that you're going to be able to cross the mountains on top of it. So it's even more advantageous because then you can take advantage, whereas your opponents cannot take advantage of that.
Silly Grim, you don't get science for science victory. You get science for domination victory.
Yeah.
Science is for nukes.
Also, all that money saved, especially in the early game, means you might be able to just straight up buy your universities faster than anybody else, and therefore you're getting more science buildings online sooner.
You know, it's interesting. Mega Bears fan actually refers to the scientific victories as a good fallback.
What?
Regardless of whether you played aggressive or cooperative, especially if you have a large populous empire.
Fallback?
No.
Fallback.
No. If you find yourself against Carthage, both the uniques are quickly obsoleted, so they're only a threat if start with Carthage as an immediate neighbor. Yes, well.
Mm-hmm. Hello?
Mm-hmm. Dido is one of, if not the most deceitful AI leaders in the game. Oh, I wouldn't necessarily say the most deceitful. Absolute statements are absolutely problematic. But yes, she is deceitful. She's perfectly happy to declare war on you if she doesn't like you, or even if she does like you. Well, that's just a fine line between love and hate going on there. Be very cautious of any friendships or alliances you may forge with her. She also has high flavors of naval unit production. Good. And water connections, meaning she should prioritize coastal settlements. Her AI has an oddly mediocre flavor for trade, despite her powers.
Yeah. She can trade a lot. Good for her.
Just don't leave yourself defenseless. I can't imagine those elephants being anything in AI hands that you would worry about.
Yeah, well, it depends.
Build, like, two spears and turn them into pin cushions like any other AI invasion early on, and that's that.
Yeah, it just depends on spam.
Yeah, I guess.
Thank you, Mega Bears fan, for these revisits of Civilization V, Civilizations, post-Brave New World, and patches. That's going to take us to the 2015 Turncast and Polycast Listener Feedback Survey results. Part 2 of 2. We will start with Turncast. Asked about number of episodes to publish as opposed to episode length, because that ties into the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign, which we'll get to. But I said, in order to rank your preference for the number of episode releases per season, the choices were 6, 13, or 8. Overall, as a weighted average, between 13 and 18, not much difference. A mix of play between Civilization Beyond Earth and Civilization V is an ongoing effort on Turncast. What's your preference? Well, 10 of the 12 people responded saying they wanted Civilization V and then Civilization Beyond Earth. Although, given most of the feedback we received, which was more-ish and more-ish, I think that can be experienced equally whether we're talking about Civilization V or Civilization Beyond Earth.
Yeah, Mackie.
What?
Actually, yes, Mackie should sing more was another piece of feedback we received.
Mm-hmm. Which one of you entered that?
I don't know. The piece of feedback ended with what, so I'm kind of inclined towards Phil.
I actually did not participate in that, so my influence is felt there clearly, but it was not me.
And from that point was also, we need more explicit content, combined with another piece of feedback, which was, not sure what to say here, always enjoyable, perhaps slightly more effective, swearing censoring.
Yeah.
What?
The swear censor is you don't hear the entire length of the profanity, but you hear enough at the beginning and or end to know what the profane word is. Holycast. On December 1st, 2015, a Patreon campaign was begun. 54% of respondents said, I am not a patron and do not intend to become one, but I was actually more surprised by the 46% that said, I am not a patron, but do intend to become one. Ooh, certainly there's no commitment there. Certainly we're not going to hold you to that, even if I could figure out exactly
yeah,
what we're.
Exactly.
But it's nice to know that it is at least being considered and not outright rejected. As for the feedback itself, which I think this was only the second year that we had this kind of open-ended question, some perspective about what people are looking for, not only when they look back on the show over a year, but if you're not interested in sending us an email or leaving us a voicemail or on a Civ community forum, this is a prominent way to give us feedback. And at a good time when we're planning for what are we going to do differently in the coming year, what are we going to keep the same, etc. Just kind of the general positives. Always a grand source of enjoyment, listening to you a lot, keep up the great work. Keep it up. Continue your great work. Like lots of the co-hosts and interviews with Firaxis team members. All positive. Really enjoyed 2015 and look forward to 2016. And I think a segment highlighting cool mods would be really interesting, but otherwise Polycast is great and keep up the great work. Don't forget to be awesome.
Needs more singing.
If you're looking for cool mod discussion, head on over to and listen to Modcasts. Modding is not something we would be discussing on Polycast. What about you, Matt? Is there a comment or two you wanted to raise specifically?
There's a couple actual production-related ones that I think are useful. Post-production delay is detrimental to news section, which is sort of true. News becomes old news by the time the episode is released, which is definitely true, especially in situations where, like, this was just announced, and then we tell somebody about it 2 weeks later.
I figured you were going to bring that up first, based on there are some production-related comments, and I thought, oh, here we go. You can infer this in a couple of ways. Either we should be recording episodes every week,
no.
Or there should be not as a delayed turnaround between episode recording and episode release. The 7-day delay... When we talk about news, and to my way of thinking, we're bringing it up not because you heard it here first, more about let's go in depth. What are people talking about in relation to this? What are the connections to this and something else that we've talked about before, which when you're trying to report it first, you're not going to go into as much depth. I certainly agree that it is detrimental in the sense of timing, but I think that is balanced out by the fact that we're able to kind of take a step back from the news and see what happens once it is announced. Whether it's what the community feedback is or whether or not, hey, after that was announced in the news, there was then a response from those who published the news and or they changed something. So take from that what you will.
I take it that Dan just doesn't want to release the episode that quickly.
He does have to actually edit things.
Yeah, no, this is a day job. I mean, Dan would have to get an assistant.
That's just it. I don't want to just record this episode and then release it with no post-production whatsoever. I could do that, but then there'd be so many things about it, not just the technical quality, but the quality of the content, the continuity of the content. It's just not as polished a product. If I didn't have a full-time job, and I do now, and that's a good thing, but because of that and also other things that I have in my personal life that are not Polycast, is that news? That might be. It's just not practical. If I tried to do this any more quickly, then I would rush and I would make mistakes. And I'm certain if no one else called me out on them, I would call myself out on them. I want to minimize the likelihood that I'm going to do that ever, let alone week after week, episode after episode.
Yeah, takes time. Yeah.
We do this because we enjoy talking about Civ. We don't want to get it to the point where it does feel like a job.
It's hard enough to set my alarm for like the crack of noon or like 11:30 one time a week. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's the weekend. You're supposed to sleep in, dang it.
Although, if I could convince my employment to work us in during weekdays, it might not be the worst thing.
Feedback matters.
Sometimes.
Now, Grim.
We haven't listened to a single complaint.
Exactly.
Well, did anyone actually really complain? I mean, honest complaint, not just blah, blah, blah.
Yes.
Probably a couple, but who cares?
There's probably a couple.
Who cares?
Well then.
Well, no, some of it's like, I hate 5 and Bert, so I refuse to listen to Polycast until 6 comes out. Like, yeah, good
okay.
for you.
Okay.
All right.
I mean, if it says I don't listen anymore and this is a reason why, and it was actually something to do with the show, that actually, good.
Yeah, that would be valid feedback.
If you're not playing Civ 5 or Civ Bert, then for now, anyway, Polycast, you're not part of the intended audience.
No way. I want everyone to listen to us, regardless of if they've ever played Civ in their life. Just listen to Polycast, guys. It'll be good times.
I guess the only other one that's in there is just moving open mic segment to the middle or to the end of it. Mostly because the viewer's interest was if they put on an episode of Polycast, they want to get into nice Civ related content first and, you know, get in the mindset. Doesn't want to care about how we got an email. But, you know, once the flow of the show is going, then it's fine. It's just their way of suggesting that maybe content should be upfront rather than feedback. I'm actually okay with it.
My immediate response to that is feedback is content or can be content. I think it depends on the nature of the message and also what else we're going to be talking about in that week. I'm not adverse to saying in the back of my mind, all else being equal, have it towards the middle or the end of the show. But I'm not going to also say that we'll never put it at the front. Even if in the recording we talk about open mic first, going back to that comment, I might decide, you know what, that's fine towards the middle of the end in the post-produced version. That's another advantage of post-production.
I think one thing that would move you towards putting it sooner is if it's regarding strategy discussion from the previous episode. It's one of those situations where we talked about a mechanic and then something new comes up that causes new decision making compared to what we were talking about 2 weeks ago or whatever, then that could be placed earlier.
Hmm. Well, it's also flow. Right. So yeah. If we're talking about a related topic and something had gotten put up in open mic, either email or whatever, and it flows with the topic.
And I've heard other podcasts do that, put the listener feedback towards the front of the show and then get on to the main topics type of a thing.
Especially when the feedback we're talking about is responses to the last episode.
Yes, particularly that. Yeah.
I still think it's more on flow than upfront. I agree with that. I didn't write it. Don't worry. But
I agree with myself.
I'm glad you felt the need to say that, Jin.
Yeah. No, I do sort of agree with that. But if Sid turns around and sends us feedback, we'll probably talk about that first, mostly because Sid actually sent us feedback. But other than that, there's lots of nice positive things people said, like they like our chemistry and we should stick together forever. When will Grimbeck be on the show? That is literally part of the feedback.
How about now? Done.
Well, there you go.
See, Dan does listen to your feedback.
Yep. Oh, and from that, do you think there will be any Civ 6 talk in 2016?
Nope.
Yes, because people want Civ 6.
No. Nope.
That's straightforward.
Only thing we can say about Civ 6 is we want Civ 6.
Yeah.
There we go.
And that is talking about it, so yes.
True.
There.
Next topic.
We've talked about Civ 6. We're done for 2016. You're welcome, Internet. Oh, and this ties back to the Patreon. Love the podcast. You guys are awesome. I'm not a patron only because I can't spend the donation amounts offered. If there was a more modest one, I definitely would become a patron. So if you were the person who submitted that piece of feedback or you are following along with that and haven't looked at our Patreon campaign since December or early January, check it out because there has been changes. Just go to the polycast.net/Patreon. I won't summarize it here, but in part, in response to that, I changed not only the milestone goal totals, but also the individual incentives for people. Although I will say you do not have to input that minimum amount. You can input any amount you want, which also goes with someone who said, I would like to see donations up to one-time donations of any amount. On the Polycast website, there's still the PayPal button. We've had that up there for about 4 years, but it's been a little more than 2 years since we received one. So it wasn't about saying, okay, we're not looking for one-time donations anymore. This was just, perhaps if it was presented in a different way, also saying we're going to do something with that, potentially do something with that money that's being provided to us, other than just saying thank you, as it were, that perhaps it would incentivize more people to do that. But yes, you can still make one-time donations.
Yeah. Also, but related to that, perhaps when the big Patreon money bags come rolling in, regular co-hosts can get a well-deserved upgrade to their microphones, because apparently microphone quality is a pet peeve of this person. I understand it. We don't all have radio quality headsets or setups.
Professional microphones.
And a lot of guest co-hosts tend to not even have a proper headset.
See, I kind of get that a little more if it was a guest co-host thing, but I think it's more practical that they said regular co-host because that would be four people potential as compared to the typical 20 plus guests that we have on the show.
Yeah.
It's not like we reach through the internet and hand them the microphone and go, here's your microphone for this week, you know?
There are a couple of comments about regular co-hosts. One was embedded as part of other comments that we've read from this individual. Apparently the poll would not let me not vote for a favorite co-host, so Mackie gets my vote. Or my favorite is actually, I only picked Dan because he facilitates the information. Well, hey.
That's pretty darn important, so.
That's fine. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Yeah, it's kind of useful that somebody picks what we're talking about.
Yeah, Dan's a facilitator.
I typically like most everything from the episodes, although sometimes I think that not enough time is spent on some topics. Yeah, it's always about, do we want to cover five topics and spend, you know, 10, 15 minutes on each, or do we want to cover 10 and talk like 5 minutes on it each? It depends often on what the topic is, what else there is to talk about, the number of panelists that we have. We typically have five, but sometimes it's four or even six, and who those panelists are.
And do we want to spend the whole episode ranting about this one thing?
We've occasionally done that, but that has been the exception rather than the rule. Someone wants us to go over lots of tactics, talk about competitive ladders, make some Civ challenges where save games get uploaded and people compete to finish a goal the fastest. We've talked about those in the past, maybe more in Civilization 4, but those kind of Civ challenges things I think lend itself to a print, i.e. going onto a Civ forum medium rather than a podcast.
Yeah, I think so, because you really want to talk about how things were accomplished or why one player chose their action versus another and seeing the result of that choice in practice. Yeah, and the audio format of the show just does not lend itself well to screenshots and understanding explanations coming from multiple people about multiple game scenarios. Despite the same start, things can shake out very differently, and there's no way you could really keep track of it in the detail that makes those a useful format in an audio-only show. Now, once we upgrade to our video show...
No.
In closing here, a few last comments. Maybe a record of opinion on certain topics or maybe a frequently asked question to cover topics that get asked. To me, for example, a search engine like Google is your friend. If you're wondering if we've talked about something, put in quotation marks the word or the phrase that you are looking for and then limit your search to our website. That combined with go onto our season pages and do just searches for keywords. We've got detailed show notes on there. Not so much about a record of opinion, because we kind of want you to listen to the show, but certainly topics that are going to be covered. Imagine a show that actually wants people to listen to it. Strange. Support the ongoing Polycast Patreon campaign.
Collective achievements.
Personal incentives.
Month-to-month commitment.
For more information, visit thepolycast.net/Patreon.
Call in today.
In North America, 301-637-7659.
In Europe, 441-228-8-7659.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
Log on to the series' official website at
thepolycast.net.
All right, so this has been Polycast episode 247. I'm your host, Matt Jin, and then there's all the other people. Ha! Just kidding.
True, however.
Anyways, we've been joined by regular co-hosts, Mackie.
Hi.
Did she just walk away?
Mackie has left the internet. Now there's no women on it. Oh, no. Dad. That's what Mackie gets for missing your prompt.
Yeah. What's up with that? Is she muted? She's muted. I bet you she's muted.
It could very well be.
Okay.
She's probably writing on her blog. Dear blog.
Dear blog, I'm muted.
LOL face.
The me and team.
Hi.
And quick.
Now with 25% more inappropriate anecdotes.
And we finally, after all these years, finally, and he didn't even say more than a couple words, Grimbeck.
That's not true. I thought.
See, only a couple words.
Grim, seeing as how it took you so long to get on the show, you've really accumulated a lot of fees, and you're actually going to have to appear at least once more.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It's that bad, I know. I didn't want to bring it up on a live stream. Okay, I kind of did. But
I didn't want to bring up a live stream, but I'm telling you now on the live stream.
Are you going to send your men after me again?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Instead, this time he's going to bribe Shaka on you.
And Mackie may actually say something because, you know, she was not here when I prompted her.
You could just use my high for her.
Yeah.
Record date?
January 23rd, 2016.
Civilization 4, 5, and Beyond Earth sound clips. Copyright Take 2 Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.